We all know that cars mean traffic, errands, and budgets.
But they should also represent freedom and fun. Join us as we work to find everyone a car they'll love. I'm Paul.
I'm Todd. And this is the Everyday Driver Car Debate.
We are back. You may have been wondering, wait a minute, didn't Friday go by? Wasn't Podcast 350 supposed to happen already? You may be asking these questions. In fact, you're probably, if you're listening, you're in one of two groups, I just realized. You either have seen our social media and you know what happened, or you have no idea where the heck we were.
Yeah, guys, we are recording remotely because I am actually still in Washington after we came up here to shoot some cars from one of our sponsors, Griot's Garage, and that was Thursday through Saturday, and we were supposed to post that 350 podcast on Friday, but unfortunately we were not able to. Because
that is the subtle way to put that. That is the no big deal way to put it. Because what happened is we went to dinner Thursday night. Okay, I should actually set the scene better than that. We flew in first thing Thursday
morning. Yeah, there
we
go. Yeah. Yeah.
And we shot all day. Now, keep in mind, Paul is staying for another few days for Thanksgiving. So he's brought more than just shoot gear. We brought all our shoot gear because we're shooting an episode of TV.
Right.
Plus Chance and I's gear to be in town for three-ish days. Okay? So we have – I'm just going to tally this real quick. I have a duffel. Chance has a carry-on-sized rollabout thing. You have a carry-on-sized rollabout thing of clothes. You also have a large duffel. You also have – we both have Pelican cases of gear. We have a separate monster Pelican case of hard gear, and there's gear in every one of our duffels. And we each have a backpack, which each has an external drive and a laptop in it.
Right.
So if you laid them all out, it's probably eight pieces of luggage for three guys.
A lot of gear. Three laptops, all our cameras, four GoPros, all of this stuff. Yeah, backup
so
drives.
So we end up shooting. We go straight from the airport to shoot location. We shoot all day. So of course we haven't been to the hotel. All of our personal stuff is in the van. We put all our gear in the van. We go to dinner. If you don't know the story already, you're probably seeing what's about to happen.
Yeah,
we come
out
from dinner.
Yeah.
And the Turo van that we rented, the Toyota Sienna, no longer has a passenger sliding door window, and the entire van has been wiped out, picked clean. All our stuff is gone.
Yeah, this hit me pretty hard. I know it hit all of us. It just, I was just blasted by this because we came back to the van and Chance said, "Wow, guys, there's a lot of glass everywhere." And we kind of looked back like, huh, you know, somebody broke a bottle or something on the street thinking that. And I looked back and the van was cleared out and the right side passenger window was smashed clean. The glass was all over the inside of the car. And like Todd said, we had come back from the shoot, going straight to dinner and then straight to the hotel after that to pretty much dump footage, go to bed, you know, get up the next morning.
Totally. We had a shoot the next day.
We're in shoot mode. We're talking things through. We're talking how the day went. You know, we just needed food and then needed sleep, that kind of thing, in that order.
Yeah.
Looking back, and then it just slowly, bit by bit, settled into us going, oh my gosh, wait just a minute.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind a couple things. Everything we shot on Thursday was still on the cards in the cameras. Now, if there's some of you – look, this is one of those situations where armchair quarterbacking happens. I get it. There's a million other ways we could have tackled this. But the truth is, as you may have already gleaned, there was way too much stuff for us to pull out of the van and haul into a restaurant.
And I've kicked myself already enough for not realizing and should have, would have,
anybody would have – we never would have taken – nobody in their right mind would have cleared out the van to go into the restaurant.
Well,
I have no idea.
I've even thought, well, just take your backpack or just take that. And I've kicked myself a lot.
Theoretically. But the better thing is, you know, don't rob stuff out of somebody's van. But anyway.
Ideally.
Yeah, exactly. That'd be the way to go. But ultimately, here's the story. All, and I do mean all of the gear we used to produce the TV show was all in the van and is now all gone. All of us have laptops where we are each cutting separate things related to the Corvette film. That work is now gone. By the way, the Corvette footage we have, it's just the work we had with us, gone. But Chance had all of his stills from the Corvette shoot on a drive that he brought to add to. It's his Everyday Driver external drive.
Yep.
That's gone.
And
you had an external drive of personal stuff and Everyday Driver stuff.
I had three external drives with me. I mean,
right,
like family
one
photos.
Family.
It was going to be sort of a file photo download with the family and just get some, get all the photos organized. And so I took all the backups of our podcast as well. So the last year of podcasts that are on Podcast One and on iTunes, those are intact because they've been uploaded to this giant cool thing called the cloud. But the backups, I don't have anymore. So I don't have those original copies, which is horrifying to me.
Podcast edits.
Yeah, I know the edits and the original recordings. So I don't have that anymore. And everything that was on our laptops. Laptops are expensive, by the way. These MacBooks are, they don't give them away. So they're
that's true.
Just painful with a lot of personal stuff on there. You had writing. You mentioned to me you had, just various writing of scripts or books that you were, thinking about. You had
a Lancer
interview. I had a Bite and Cars interview still from Pebble Beach that I had done. Gone. It's horrifying. And, and the magnitude is still gutting to me, even though we're at this point, we're resolute, we're strong, we're coming back, but you guys need to know this story just so you know where we're coming from, and that's why Podcast 350 didn't drop. I edited it on the airplane. It sounded great. We were funny.
Well, see,
it was going to be awesome.
That's the key thing is that 350 was ready to upload.
Yeah.
Part of our Thursday night when we left the restaurant was go back to the hotel and upload 350. But 350 only existed on your external drive, and it's now gone. So here we are. Yep. By the way, welcome to Podcast 350 and happy Tuesday. We're going to redo the All Questions podcast right now, this evening, here in a minute. But I want to kind of land the plane on what happened with this whole robbery thing. I can't overestimate the cost of the gear. I mean, look, the gear is stuff. It can be replaced. Mm-hmm. But my God, it's expensive. Luckily, yes, for those of you wondering, yes, we do have production insurance that we carry for the show. But two things you have to keep in mind. One, that has a deductible.
Yeah.
And two, there's stuff it will not cover. There's just peripheral stuff that just, it's like that doesn't get covered, but the big stuff does. If I had to guess, and I don't have, we're still compiling the full tally a few days later. It's going to be between $15,000 and $20,000 worth of gear that was gone.
They stole clothes and shoes and my entire suitcase. And then we looked at each other and realized the things that are on your body, the clothes that are on your body is all you have right now. That's it.
That's all we wore for 3 days.
And our phones and our wallets.
I was wearing that for 3 days. Yeah, exactly. but forget clothing and that kind of stuff for a minute. It was the better part of $20,000 worth of gear.
Yeah, absolutely.
Production gear.
I would have let the gear go if we could just have those chips off the cameras, the SD cards,
all
the GoPros.
All the data.
I just want the data back. I don't care about stuff can be replaced. It's all replaceable. Yeah. It's all fine. It's just stuff, right? Nothing money can't solve, as my dad always says.
True. But this is the thing, obviously there's lots of money involved to get us back to a place where we're up and running. But you guys listening, I can't overstate how shocking and humbling this was. And my wife put it best, because I called her and she was as shocked as we were. But my wife put it best. She said, you have a moment like we had where you see the worst of humanity and it impacts you. But then 24 hours later, maybe 12 hours later, we encountered what I would describe as the best of humanity, and that's you guys.
Yeah,
because
for sure.
When I posted to social media that we'd been robbed, it was for no reason other than to let you guys know, by the way, it's Friday morning, you're waking up to a podcast and there isn't one. Why isn't there one? Here's why. That was the entire reason I posted. And you guys listening picked up that idea and kind of called out for a GoFundMe page, something that I hadn't even thought of. Honestly, I've never even used GoFundMe. So I was like, what?
This is astounding.
I mean, I'm aware of it, but
So
then Derek, who's one of our patrons and a longtime listener, thank you, man. Derek and two or three others. I mean, honestly, our email box Friday morning was multiple of you. You don't even realize this, guys. Multiple of you going, can I set up a GoFundMe page?
Yeah.
And
that
the only
was
person
cool.
that didn't ask first, and I don't mean this to be tacky, but the only person that didn't ask first was Derek, who went and did it. And just said, here it is. Here it is. Close it if you don't want it. But by the time he'd set it up, it was already getting some traction. The truth is, guys, that GoFundMe page has floored us. Your generosity, your support of the show has floored us. That is going to be the deductibles and the extras.
Look,
and if...
Well, yeah, continue. Keep going.
Well, if for some reason, I mean, this would be a nice world, isn't it? If for some reason our insurance and the GoFundMe page results in more money than we needed to replace our gear, guess where that goes? That goes into making more show.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So you guys, I cannot thank you enough for that. That was a left turn I didn't expect, but it's going to be hugely helpful. It's already been helpful. If you are interested in the GoFundMe page, it's on all our social media. I will put a link on our website if you're curious. If you want to be generous and support the show in that regard, I am humbled by it. Thank you.
I'm floored by it as well. Thank you, guys. I had mentioned to Todd, you know, with all the California wildfires going on, and I said, you know what, you know, we didn't just lose our homes. I mean, there's people who have been devastated by these wildfires.
Yeah.
They've lost everything. We didn't lose everything, but we lost a big chunk of our livelihood, and we lost a big chunk of editing and, you know, the things that we're sharing with you guys and the season four editing and all this stuff. We didn't lose season four or the Corvette film. It just was a setback in terms of editing and pulling selects and all that prep work, as well as the podcast and the archives. It was a big blow, I'll be honest. And like I said, it hit me pretty hard, but we realized over the course of the evening as we were stumbling around, you know, thinking, well, I need socks and underwear for tomorrow. We need to go buy toothbrushes and toothpaste and all those things. It just, it resets you. And we realized that we needed to keep going. We couldn't just take this blow and just be done with the weekend. And so we had let our friends at Griot's Garage know. We had let Nick know and a bunch of people there. And we realized that we needed to be resolute about the show and filming that episode. And so we leaned on them and said, hey, we don't have the gear, but they did. We got a couple new GoPros. We had all the gear at our disposal because they do have a photography and video production department, and they let us use all their gear. And so it's very different gear. We shot around, you know, we were going to pull three cars, but we just ended up pulling two. But it's still, I'm really proud of what we did, and I'm proud to share that with you. So there will be the drama intermixed in this episode from Griot's, but they just came to our rescue. They helped us out tremendously. Huge thanks to everybody there. We're just
hugely thrilled
by all this.
You may remember, you know, Nick Griot was actually on the podcast a while back. So he was still our contact there.
Oh, but he pulled a couple of cars through from there. He was working so hard. He was pulling batteries out of cars. He was working on, you know, the Jag wouldn't charge. And, you know, we did have our British car experience, but he was working his tail off and just rushing to get this film done for us.
Yeah. Then they had Matt, their videographer, and John, their dedicated stills guys. And we just – I literally stood – Friday morning, I stood in their office, and I said, tell me what gear you have. And they started running down the list. And it was like I was sitting there with a menu. I started going, I'll take that camera and that lens, and no, that doesn't work for me, but how about this instead of that? And we built the gear we needed to keep shooting. Now, again, it wasn't our gear that we were comfortable with, but I was like, that'll work, and that lens fine. And, I mean, we did that for like a half hour of just gear selection. And then we went out Friday, like mid-morning, and we started again.
Yeah.
And we shot all day Friday.
Started over.
And we shot, yeah.
Although we were faster because everything we had done the prior day, we knew the setup. We knew exactly where to go. It was like practice.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing you do the second or third time, it goes a lot faster. So we were able to actually kind of catch up, which was crazy to me.
Yeah.
And then
we shot all day Friday. We shot until Chance and I had to dash for the airport on Saturday. I mean, we literally shot until Chance and I were 10 or 15 minutes past when I knew we needed to leave. And we jumped in our broken van and drove it back to the airport to hand it back to the owner, who at this point, of course, obviously we've kept him informed.
He's been very gracious through this whole thing.
He was candidly disappointed that had happened in his city. That was the thing that I just – the overwhelming demeanor from him was just, I'm apologizing on behalf of Seattle-Tacoma. And he could have been – look, I mean, not that it was our fault, of course, but he could have been difficult about it.
He could have.
He would have had that choice.
And he had that ground to stand on too. Take my van and you give it back to me like this? What on earth, guys?
Yeah. So, I mean, we'd cleaned it out and done the best we could. I mean, obviously, there was glass everywhere, and that was now gone. But at the same time, I delivered him back a van without a side window and trash bags covering up for the rain, you know? And his demeanor, Mahook, man, big shout out to you. His demeanor was just, guys, I'm sorry.
So
which was really
huge.
Cool.
Yeah, thank you. And so we pulled off the shoot. I'm so glad you guys made your flight. And then I was still driving around doing my last interview in the car and finally turned the car back in. And that was that. That wrapped up Saturday. And I was just, steamrolled. I was steamrolled emotionally. I was frazzled, but we still pulled it off because we came back to focus on the driving, and it was honestly the part of the shoot that struck me the most. And I haven't told you this. It was, despite all the storm going around us, we still focused on the fun and pleasure of driving and still able to extract that and focus on it and share that. And I'm really excited and confident in this film. I'm not excited by the footage that we got.
No, of course not.
The footage is
there are many
astounding.
Things that are yet to be edited. Well, but that's the other thing about it. Is, you know, you mentioned that, and I kept thinking about how the weekend was a weekend of extremes. Because we haven't had a blow in production on this show like that ever. Nothing of that magnitude.
I mean, we've lost an interview or two, or the audio hasn't been turned on, or you know, little things like that. But nothing of this.
Of course.
I mean, personal, like, and again, I know stuff can be replaced, but I'm still remembering and thinking of things like, oh, yeah, that was in my bag, too. Right. I'll never see that again.
Oh,
I got to go get another one.
For weeks.
Like,
totally
name
agree.
The thing, and I'm still thinking of things. It's crazy.
That's happening to me as well. but I did have the counter experience where the Jaguar E-Type, which you guys have heard me talk about on this podcast as something that's been like the car I've always wanted to drive because my dad had one. Well, I drove one briefly about 2 months ago for the first time, and now we were in an E-Type Speedster, which is kind of a middle ground between a standard E-Type and the Eagle E-Type Speedster that I talk about as the singer of E-Types that cost $500,000. Think of somewhere like the middle ground. I was in kind of that car for this shoot, and we'll explain why. But I had a moment driving along in that car where I had a break in traffic, and I put my foot in it, and I got my daily triple in an E-Type Speedster, and I just thought, this is one of the best moments ever. And how much of an extreme between what we were experiencing from a production difficulty standpoint and what we were experiencing from a personal driving standpoint, we couldn't have done more opposite end bookends. And we were having both in the same, you know, 5-6 hour period. It was crazy, but really cool. So
I think that was the emotional extremes, the swing, the pendulum back
completely.
And forth.
Oh,
my gosh, this happened. We have to go deal with everything. I mean, my checkbook was in my backpack and house keys and car keys and gone. To this extreme driving pleasure. It was unbelievable. You're right.
I don't know if you heard him say this, but of course Chance was with us, and Chance lost a bunch of gear that's getting replaced as well. I mean, it's all here. I mean, Chance, here's the thing you need to know. Chance has done some well-paying, high-profile still photography gigs outside of Everyday Driver. Mm-hmm. He works with his camera. That is his weapon of choice. That's how he makes a living, okay? So well beyond just us. So his camera's gone, you know, and he looked at me at one point. Because you go back to our discussion of the Corvette shoot all the way to now, he looked at me at one point and he went, what is up with this quarter? What is going on with this quarter of the year?
I know.
He said, can we be done with this quarter, please? So happy Thanksgiving in advance. We're looking forward to a fantastic holiday and a reset for 2019. Let's do some questions.
I agree. This is the second time around for us, but the first time for you guys. And we remember a lot of the questions that we answered. We're going to have fun with it again.
Yeah, for sure.
And I am diving straight into Facebook here from JP Dunphy.
Love it.
Asking me what I think of the Veloster and Civic Type R from a design standpoint. Is an understated yet aero effective car, less thrilling than a car that is blatantly performance-oriented like the Type R? Well, I brought up Japan, and you and I talked about Tokyo and Japan in general and the styling that works there because of, just think of anything, all the Gundam characters and the anime and all the crazy stuff that is part of the Japanese culture. They make little minivans look like Transformers. They look like sleekest, the robots, and it's a minivan. It's a box. How can you possibly do this? And yet they still do. And so actually a Civic Type R in Tokyo looks kind of bland. It really does, strangely.
It blends.
But
fair point.
What I've found with Hyundai and Kia in general, keep in mind that Peter Schreier has now stepped down. He took Kia in a new direction stylistically. He came from Audi. Mm-hmm. So think of the restrained, subtle lines that Audis represent. And then now Luc Donkervolka, he is now the head designer there. And so he's coming from a little bit, you know, of English style Bentley, a little bit of Lamborghini, Italian flair. And so with Hyundai styling, it's much more restrained than Honda is, certainly, at least for the Civic Type R. So understated aero, well, it's not necessarily less thrilling, I would say, but, you know, I like the understated part. I've always liked the understated thing, but especially the Civic Type R has pushed me over the edge. But from a design standpoint, I like cars that are actually speaking to their capabilities. And we've all seen the, you know, the Ricers and that kind of thing, where it's so beyond that, okay, that wing isn't, it's actually upside down, so you're lifting the rear wheels off the ground the faster you go. Or, you know, we all notice funny stuff like that, right? But I like cars that actually are either on par with their capabilities as far as looks, or they're a little bit subtle. But I think both car companies are pretty right on as far as their design ethos and their design philosophies. They're kind of right in there. Hyundai's in the, you know, bringing the Mazda speed thing back that we don't get anymore. And they're subtle, but the tweaks are kind of noticeable to all of us enthusiasts. Whereas the Civic Type R is just sort of kablam, you know, in your face. But again, in Tokyo, it looks like, huh, what is that boring looking thing over there? Because look at this minivan.
It just blends in. Well, this is the same culture where the guys have the neon inside the Countach doors of their Lamborghinis, and they
this
drive down the, you know, they drive down the street with the Lambo doors and their feet out. You know, it's this is the world. So
this is
I get it. Okay. It's not our world. There are two questions that actually relate that I want to start with. One came to us via email from Isaac. Another one came to us via Facebook from Alex, both relating to steering feel. Isaac's question is, does bad steering feel translate to bad handling? Or to put it another way, if a car has electric steering, does it mean it handles badly? And then Alex asking the question, can we explain steering feel? Because he doesn't feel like he knows anything about it or has ever really felt it. And is it important? I feel like those relate wonderfully. So let me speak to steering feel real quick, guys. Think of steering feel like one of your five senses in the car. If you wipe away your five senses, I'll put it to you this way. If you go to a really good dinner and you have a cold, you can still enjoy that dinner. You'll still enjoy the fact that it was a good dinner. But if you didn't have a cold, you weren't congested, it would be that much better. This is having a world of steering feel or no steering feel. First off, Isaac, if a car does not have good steering feel, it can absolutely handle wonderfully. It's still possible, okay? There are plenty of cars with no information coming through the steering, but they sure stick to the road. And wow, it handles really flat. That definitely exists. That absolutely exists. But on the other end of the spectrum, if you have a bunch of steering information, it's like opening up a new sense to you. So back to Alex's question.
That's good. I like that.
When you're cornering, okay, and if you have no steering feel, you can feel the car sliding through your butt. You can feel with your personal, like, spatial awareness of your head and your balance. You can feel what the car is doing. You have all those sensations without the steering feel. But with the steering feel, you can feel, when it's good, you can feel the grip in the wheel. Look, this is the reason I own the Lotus, okay? Because there is no better just full-on steering feel. And that's the thing that makes that car so magical, honestly.
Yeah, I see that.
If I ignore the steering feel, the Lotus still feels light and agile, even without the steering feel information. But the steering feel is just this constant kind of rumble of info that is kind of like what your sense of smell adds to your sense of taste, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So I think it is important. And Alex, I really recommend to you, you get in some cars that are known for their steering feel just to get a sense of when the wheel has vibration that was generated by the tires. Especially a lot of electric steering now, that's not where any of that comes from. That it's being created artificially, and you don't feel the granular – sorry, I don't know another way to put it – the granular nature of what the tires are doing. When you feel that, you may not like it, honestly. I will admit it's not for everybody. But once you get that, you go, oh, I see. This is what this is now. And maybe you'll want it, but you cannot have it and still have a good handling car.
No, interesting. I like that that analogy that you were using. I'm moving to Michael D's question here on Facebook. Michael, you have no idea how long we have debated this before we finally are getting it out, the answer, and talking about your question here. He writes to us and says, I really and truly don't understand how a modern family survives without a truck or a full-size SUV.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw this.
He says, not everyone needs one, but everyone needs access to one. Yet our podcast seems to actively work around recommending them. So here's the question. How many times a year should a person be expected to rent a vehicle before you're justified in just going ahead and buying one? Michael?
Yeah. How are you going to handle this, sir?
I'm going to start with Europe. I'm going to start with Volkswagen
Great.
Golf Caddy. And this is a model that we do not get in North America or the States.
All right.
It's a slightly enlarged Golf. It's like a puffy, slightly overweight Golf. And this serves as sort of a family wagon for most families in Europe because they don't have the size for an Expedition. Now, I am pointing all the fingers at me because I own an Expedition. It was an inherited vehicle mainly for sentimental reasons. But do I need it? No, it is enormous. Everybody who ever drives it or rides in it is astounded by the space and they luxuriate. You slide around. It's like first class. Have you ever been, flying on first
That's
class?
That's a good description.
And you think, ooh. Because back in the exit row, I've got the length, but I don't have the width. So think about back to Europe here. There's so many families that do have more than one kid, and they've got it all handled. Somehow, magically, they've figured out how to truck all their kids' stuff around, get them to school, to everything, all their after-school activities, and yet they still don't need this giant SUV. It's like you move from your first apartment into your bigger apartment, or then into a bigger condo, or then into a house. And over the years, you just accumulate more stuff. You've got the space, so you just fill it up. It's very difficult to have the space and not fill it with either you, feet, your stuff. You know what I mean? If you're sitting in a bigger chair, will you spread out more? If you're sitting in a smaller one, you're just kind of tucking back in and making it work.
Yeah.
So for the expectations of renting a vehicle, well, you know, it honestly, we'll say pickup trucks for contractors, that kind of stuff, totally justified. That's your business. That's your job.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But do you need it? I mean, we see so many people all around Park City, everywhere, driving big cars just because they like them. Now, it's the difference between a want and a need. You might just want that high driving position.
Oh,
you want the space.
Yeah.
You want the size. You feel safer. Okay. I mean, that's the, you know, that is the choice, right? But do you need it? No.
Yeah, everything you're saying, you're absolutely right. Everything you're saying, and I want to speak to it this way, Michael, space that is accomplished by these large, full SUVs is a luxury, not a necessity. And I'll give you a couple of examples. We know, and you're asking quite, and there's a sub question here where you're talking about what about Home Depot runs? What about the families in for the extended families in for the vacation or the holiday or what? I get that, but look, one of the people that had one of the 911s in our 50 years of 911 film. Her name was Diane. She had that early 2000s 911. She's a single mom with two kids, and the 911 was her only car. In fact, she has a different one now. Still her only car. And she's described many times about doing the school run on her 911 and then going to Home Depot and picking up mulch because she loves to garden.
Right.
This is a woman who never rents an SUV, Michael. So it's right back to what we're talking about here. And what you said, Paul, about Europe, tons of families get by. This is why wagons thrive in Europe. They don't need big cars. In some cities, they can't handle big cars, and they do just fine. When you get more space, you luxuriate. And back to us, to you and me, Paul, we have done a full television shoot, and the only gear production vehicle was the Mini.
It's astounding. I know. It seems crazy.
We've used the Expedition, too. We've done an equivalent shoot in the Expedition with the same amount of gear. The difference is, in the Expedition, everything has its own spot with 6 inches on either side. You can just go grab that thing. In the Mini, it's like, oh, pick up that one and then that one, and there's the piece of gear you need. But they both got the shoot done. So to your question, Michael, of how often before this is necessary, I think if you're renting a larger vehicle once a month, it's time to buy a larger vehicle. If you're going to Home Depot once a quarter to buy something big, you need a bigger vehicle for 2 hours. Rent it from Home Depot and call it a deal. The reason they don't come up, Michael, is because nobody needs us to be champions for the SUV. They're selling just fine, thank you.
they're selling without us either, negating the merits of the driving feel or, you know, saying these are amazing.
But nobody's buying them for the driving sensation. We're buying them for their utility, that utility word in their name. That's why we're buying them. We like the luxury of the space. But what we hope you do is have a car that you love to drive, and the larger things get, typically the less fun they get. I know there's exceptions to every rule, but generally that's the reason we don't talk about them, because we know why everybody gets them. They're selling fine. Let's champion the other stuff.
They're bigger. You want more space. It's the supersized.
More is always
kind
better.
Of thing.
It's the American way.
You go order in a fast food restaurant and you tell them that you don't want to upgrade, you want the small drink, and they'll look at you like, now let me find the small cups for that drink. I don't know where we keep those.
For sure.
I haven't seen those in a while. Nobody orders them. All right.
That's awesome.
What else do you have?
Rowan wrote in on Facebook, and he said, what's wrong with me? I've fitted performance tires to my SUV. I now take a longer, twisty road to work. I find the racing line through corners. I'm trail braking as much as I can. What's wrong with me? Rowan, I'm confused by your question. I don't see what's wrong. I don't see the problem.
Right.
Actually, you know what? If you want me to unpack this, Rowan, I'll tell you what's wrong. You still have an SUV. Otherwise, welcome. Welcome to the
exactly.
disease. In fact, I say, back to Michael's question, can you get by without the SUV, or can you buy something really little to go with your SUV and embrace the disease? Thanks for being with us here on the podcast.
Awesome. Well, there's a question over here on Instagram from MeganStrong94 asking, what is the best-looking car of the past 10 years? I am saying Jaguar F-Type. I am a Porsche.
Oh, that's a good one.
Super enthusiast, super freak. You know me. But I'm looking at the F-Type, and that car turns my head every time. The noise coming out of it, it's all part of the experience. But yes, I really think Jaguar continues to nail it. There were some models that I don't love, I admit, but this car is just, it's beautiful. It's gorgeous.
You know, you made me think of this. In a similar vein, I'm going to say Aston Martin Vantage. The V8 Vantage just got replaced with the
similar
new design.
Similar size, actually.
Yes, and look, I think that the Vantage design that just got replaced, I think that is going to be one of those cars that ages like the 300ZX or the Jag E-Type, where 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, people are going to be like, that's a pretty car.
Mm, sure, sure.
I really think so.
I can see that. All right, well...
Adam.
Yeah, what else?
Did you see Adam's question? Adam's question's hard.
Where was this?
But I gave it some thought.
Okay.
Adam's question is kind of a list, but I broke it down, Adam. I took on the challenge of your question. With 30 grand to spend, he gives a list of cars. What buyers get recommended each of the following at 30 grand?
Oh.
And I read this and kind of scratched my head and went, what is this? And then I realized there's a pattern here. He's giving pairs of cars. Generally, he's giving pairs
right,
of cars.
Right.
So why A versus B, okay? I'm going to try to tackle this. This is a bit of a challenge. I'm going to try to tackle this. Okay. So why would certain cars be recommended? The first pair is the first gen, the 987 Cayman S.
Mm.
But the first half of that generation, the 987.1 that had the IMS problem, versus the second half of that generation, the 987.2 without the IMS problem, but now the base version. So the first Cayman S versus the slightly later Cayman base. You get the Cayman S because you really want a well-sorted, dedicated, two-seat sports car with usability and a luxury interior, and one of the best mid-engines out there. You want all of that in a package. You buy that Cayman S, and it's brilliant. Why did you buy the 0.2 instead? Because you want all of that, but you are still terrified of the IMS bearing. That's why.
I love how you're breaking down the Porsche minutia of all the models, and you're bringing all this knowledge. I love that. I find that really entertaining, actually.
Without even being the Porsche guy. I have weird, dusty corners in my brain. But, you know, while we're in Porsche minutia, there is one more Porsche pair, and then the rest of Adam's list is not Porsche. He says the 996. Now, that's the, like, 99 to 04 911. The 996 C4S versus the 997. That's the next generation, base of the next gen. Why do you get the unloved 996 over the 997, or why would we recommend one or the other? The 996, here's my answer, is because you, as the person shopping, have always wanted a 911, but you felt like they're out of reach because you need a sports car that does everything you can imagine, plus get beat on in the winter, have kids, and, you know, what happens? Something happens to it. It can't be precious at all. And as a result, you don't really have a need for a really nice interior. 996 is for you, my friend. But why the 997 by comparison? You've always wanted a 911. You've just now got almost enough money to get one, but you need it to be reliable and you want a good modern car that's going to feel special. That's why you go 997.
Wow. Bringing the Porsche love. This is awesome.
I'm trying. No, the last pair, and then I've got some stragglers. The last pair is C6 Corvettes from Adam. Why would you get a Grand Sport and why would you get a C6 Z06? The person for the Grand Sport is the person that wants a usable, cross-country capable sports car with good power and cheap maintenance.
Okay, all right.
Transport will go anywhere you want. You want to commute? All right. Great. You want to drive it cross-country? Fine. You want to throw golf clubs in it? Plenty of room. Why the C6-Z06 instead? You want all of everything I just mentioned, but you really want to go to the racetrack. Z06, 7-liter engine, happy person. Okay.
Wow. I'm
three
liking
left,
this.
And they're all three left, and they're all stragglers. First off, the BMW M235i for $30,000. Why does that get recommended? Well, because somebody needs a business feeling car. They need an anonymous rear wheel drive, really genuinely fun car with back seats, but it needs to be anonymous in their business parking lot.
Okay.
Nobody
all
knows
right.
how awesome that is, but they want a good, dedicated rear wheel drive sports car, and they need more than two seats. M235i.
Ooh.
The last two. Why would we recommend an Elise to you? Because you are the rare person, kind of weird like me, who you want the most. You've got $30,000 to spend. And for $30,000, what is the most exotic, focused, compromised sports car you can find? All that matters is driving. A Lotus Elise is for you.
Wow.
And finally, why the AP2 S2000? Why would you recommend that? Because you are a person who wants a convertible, and you wish the Miata was sharper and faster. There's your list, Adam. I've tried.
Holy cow. That's great. I love it. All right. Before we take an ad break here, there's a quick question from I Am Not Sean Clark asking, what is the dorkiest looking car that is currently in production? I have the answer. It is the Rolls-Royce Cullinan. Not only is it a giant hulking SUV, have you seen this thing? This is shameful. I actually had the chance to sit in this at Pebble Beach when I was there. And I sat in it and I just felt, what on earth? Why am I sitting in this car? Why did I even want to sit down?
What are we doing?
I wanted to just get in it just for the experience. And I thought, no, I didn't. What am I doing here? It was, and they're going to sell a lot of them, by the way. They're going to,
of course they are, yeah,
build them forever, and they're going to sell a lot of them. It'll be Rolls-Royce does the G-Wagon, and they're going to sell them for 30 years or something.
They will be all over the Middle East and Beverly Hills, and they'll probably have some in Park City, and I will laugh and point. So that's how that will work, yeah. Well, we're going to be right back, guys, with so many more questions. Thank you, guys. I'm sorry that we're having to do this twice. Of course, you didn't have to do it twice, but I hope you're enjoying. We have so many more questions for another half hour at least of podcast. But real quick, we want to cover some business. We're going to start off with Geico because everybody's got a to-do list. You got to drop off the dry cleaning, pick up some milk. I've got an idea for you. Let's save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. The good thing is you don't have to drop off or pick up anything.
All you've got to do is go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket? This may just be the most rewarding to-do thing on your list today. We were also talking about Rad Power Bikes. By the way, Rad Power is based in Seattle, which is pretty cool. They are a consumer-direct electric bike company that produces 5 unique electric models, electric bikes. So that means they're a consumer direct brand, and that means buyers get a premium electric bike without paying the huge markups caused by dealers and third-party retailers. We've all experienced that. So they're half the price of comparable bikes on the market because the dealer markups are cut out. So on top of this already awesome pricing schedule here, this Cyber Monday, November 26, 2018, Rad Power Bikes is making it even easier to get people riding. They're giving you deals on all the models of their electric bikes. And by the way, on their website, I like the Mini, the small one. It's a fat tire.
Okay.
It's really cool looking. Actually, it's the Rad Mini electric folding fat bike. It's really cool looking.
All of their bikes have 75 watts of power in all 5 models, which is the most powerful e-bike motor you can get. Still has street legal status. You don't need a license, registration, insurance. None of that's required. And you can finance these bikes if you need one for your all-electric bike commute. You can get it for as low as 0% APR. Of course, I am not a credit advice person, so I can't answer that. All 5 models can reach 20 miles an hour without pedaling, or you can do the thing that I've actually tried, and it is cool. You can do the electric assist thing, where the electric assist is accentuating the amount of pedaling you're doing.
What's your
preference? Riders can get between 20 and 40 miles on a single charge. If you need, this is that cliche. It's like the last mile that's been debated in commuting for the last few years.
Sure.
It's that world. But you're on a bike, and we all know how to ride a bike. By the way, it's better than a bird scooter. I'm just putting it out there. If you'd like to get one, go to radpowerbikes.com/podcast to learn more. And don't forget to shop their Cyber Monday sale, November 26th. You can save big.
I can't believe it.
That Gerald is presenting the quarterly budget report with finger puppets?
Look, here comes a 1.7% decrease in fixed overhead. Hello, everybody.
No, I can't believe how easy it was to save hundreds of dollars on my car insurance with Geico.
Who are you? The projected increase in organic Q3 revenue. Hooray!
Believe it. Geico could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
We are back with continued questions. And one of them from Ziwi over on Instagram is asking me a design question, which you know is sort of like catnip. It's a little bit like bait. I can't help myself talking about design.
You can't resist. You can't resist. That's true.
It is his understanding that because of pedestrians in the street, creases and edges on cars must be filleted to no sharper than a particular radius. So how do designers make these edges appear sharper than they really are? To be honest, Ziwi, I have not heard much of discussion in design studios about pedestrians and, well, we've got to soften the design. Now, keep in mind, designers are always talking to their engineers and talking to the people actually making the cars to incorporate their design and style and saying, all right, is this going to cost more? That is really more of the discussion in a studio is this particular design going to cost more because of the return on the sheet metal? Or do they have to overstamp and overbend it like 4 or 5 times? BMW bends their sheet metal, some of their parts, about 5 times. And they press it and they overbend it a little so it springs back to the right place, which is, you know, kind of the winemaking thing, back to my winemaking analogies. Mm-hmm. But then we'll say GM makes, you know, just 3 presses, so it's, you know, a little bit more cost effective. But for pedestrians, the creases and edges, I mean, if you get hit by a car, a sharper or less sharp crease is kind of the least of your worries. That's kind of low on the list, I'd say.
Thank God that car had rounded edges when it hit me at 40.
Man.
I mean,
I got hit by a Beetle. Well, then you should be fine. Why are you limping?
Let's stay out of the street. Let's stay out of the street. I know that sounds insane, but I'm just going to say people away from cars. Just don't get hit. Anyway,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the main
thing. And also, if you're driving, stay off your phone. That's helpful, too.
Yes, anyway, please stay off your phone. The main thing is, to answer your question, is it's the lead-in from the surface to that design feature. So the greater the lead-in, the larger puddle of light, that highlight that is all along there. Mm. And so they'll accentuate that, even though the crease or edge might not be as sharp, but they're accentuating that. It's a tricking of the eye. It's the same kind of thing where the rear door cut, usually on 4-door cars, seems really aggressive and deep, and then you open the door, and the actual entrance isn't that large. It's actually the door cut is covering up the C-pillar and the fender well. And so you think, oh, well, they got a lot of style and shape out of this door, but the actual hole for me to get in the car is kind of small. Notice that next time on your cars. It's not just, you know, 1-to-1. It's not this gigantic opening. It appears that way. But those are little tricks that designers can do.
I feel a sneeze coming on. It's called Fisker Karma.
Yeah, that's a perfect example.
That C-pillar is so deceiving. I think there might be 2 feet of sheet metal that carves in from the edge of the door until you finally have your seat. That's a tiny opening.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, what do you got?
Evil Tangents, that's Dale, who is up in Tacoma area, and he runs our Lemons team. We're glad to do that every year. But he asked, why don't we or would we ever do a car of the year review? That is, look, I will admit, it is the cliched thing that every magazine and outlet does. They do their car of the year. Where would we shoot it? How would we structure it? What would be our approach?
Oh,
here's
sure.
my problem with car of the year. And I understand, please let me be clear. I understand why they're done the way they're done, because you have to chop off the list somewhere. You have to make parameters.
Sure.
But the way everybody does them as car of the year is, what are the cars? The only cars viable are ones that were released in the calendar year since the last time we did this.
Right, right.
So as a result, you get this weird mix of cars because they're only cars that came out in the last year. That's not something that I feel like is helpful for what we want to do. Look at our Focus RS review from television. We had the Focus RS. We put it with the Evo, the STI, and the Golf R. Why? Because those are its competitors. But none of those cars came out in the same year. Those are the reviews that I like the best, because I don't want to put a brand new Lamborghini with a Stelvio because they came out the same year. Right. It's interesting because, look, they came out the same calendar year, and isn't it cool we have sports cars? But I want to put, what's the new guy? We did it with the EcoBoost Mustang, too. What's the new guy that might want your money compared to the older guys or the already known to be great guys or the cars that are now in the same budget but 2 years ago were 20 grand higher?
Yeah,
that's
sure.
The stuff that interests me. So car of the year, I would almost rather like pick a market segment or two a year and tackle that market segment, highlighting it like we did with the Focus RS. What's the new boy in this market segment and all the usual suspects? And I'd love to do like two of those a year. I'd be thrilled. But a traditional car of the year, I personally don't find all that relevant for what we do here.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. All right, I'm looking at a question over here on Instagram. Alternator 33 asks, is it wrong that I'm very attracted to the new Corolla IM hatchback? I long for the days of enthusiast Toyotas. On a bigger note, why doesn't Toyota develop enthusiast cars from the ground up? The GT86 is Subaru-based, mm-hmm. upcoming Supra is BMW-based. Well, you can kind of see the trend there. You're sort of answering the question.
Yep.
They're all in collaboration and partnerships. All their past performance cars shine from their engine bay because that's what Toyota is good at, certainly. And you mentioned the AE86, which, yes, I kind of bash Corollas. Well, I do bash Corollas because of what they've become,
so.
Not because of the name. If they were to resurrect the car and the enthusiast driving experience around the name, bring it. I'd welcome that with open arms.
Sure, sure.
I really would. It's just because of what the product planners have dumbed down the car to just be such. It's not even basic transportation. It makes you hate yourself when you're driving. And with apologies to Corolla owners everywhere, you're probably listening to this in a Corolla thinking that I'm wrong. Well, I maintain that I agree. Toyota used to do this enthusiast thing, and there was a bit of spice to every model. And then they just went to super focused on being all things to everyone all around the world. And they've forgotten about their market. And I think they're climbing out of that. But from a budget standpoint, they've got to do the collaboration thing to test the market. They don't want to stick their neck out.
Yeah.
And that is cultural, to be honest. I've experienced that. That is a cultural thing, not a, you know, let's not just go crazy sales numbers and then the next month we've dropped off a cliff. That's not what they like. They want to just toe in the pool, make sure, okay, so that's successful. Okay, good. We now know that. Now we can move on. And so here's this Supra coming, and that represents a bit more influence from Toyota. Yes, the BMW influence is there too, but they're continuing to do it on a bigger and bigger scale. I hope they continue. But it's enthusiast-based, not name badge-based. A Corolla could come out that surprises us all, and I'm not going to bring the hate because it might be great. That rhymed.
Well, yeah, totally. Go back a couple podcasts. We had a Dreaming of Corollas podcast. You can hear us unpack the new IM a little bit, and that's kind of what it is. It's the old Scion kind of becoming something else. But anyway, I'd be curious to drive that car, the new Corolla hatchback. It looks decent. I'm concerned about some of the stats that I see as far as the power-to-weight ratio.
You look decent.
But it's a Corolla. It's a Corolla turning your head. When's the last time that happened? It's been a while. Let's be honest.
Actually, never
so go
said
back
that,
to that
sentence.
Podcast. Totally. Go back to that podcast and see what you think. We're curious about it as you are. We shall see. I've got a couple of quick which car is better questions here. Mr. President 55 on Instagram says, okay, the Corvette. The C7 Z06 prices are coming down, and they're about equivalent to C6 prior generation ZR1s. Which would we have? I'll tell you, the C6 ZR1 is a monster of an engine, but I think it's too much engine for that car. That car is not well enough balanced. The C6 Z06 is a fantastic car. Now, if you're going to do an all-day tracking day, you might have some overheating issues, depends on your area. I could also argue that the C7 Z06 is still too much engine, but it is a much better balanced all-around package than the C6 ZR1. I would do the C7.
Interesting.
The other one, fast car debate here, is JDoherty 787 needs a cheap daily. It needs to run, fit a couple of kids from time to time, and be reliable, cheap to maintain, and engine note is a major factor. The three he lists at similar prices: E36 M3, that is the mid-90s M3, the Golf R32, and the G37 Coupe. I think, Jay Doherty, your G37 coupe is the call there. You've got small back seats for kids when you need them. The exhaust notes on those cars were excellent. It's a Japanese car. It will probably cost the least to run, and it's got a solid engine and good handling. I think that is the most efficient economical call.
All right. All right. I like that. I can see that. Question from Nick Dorn 2.0 on Instagram, who says, is there any merit to learning to drive and spending your early driving years without some of the modern driver aids? My first car was an 02 Mustang with 5-speed, no traction control, stability control, or ABS. And he says the combination of this analog car and Wisconsin winters on crummy all-season tires taught a lot about car control and managing the inputs.
Wow.
We are in wholehearted agreement. Absolutely. We highly encourage, as a matter of fact, but it's difficult to get that experience anymore because even, you know, 5-year-old used cars have quite a bit of interference and ABS going on, and you don't quite know if that's you or the car saving you, or if that was you doing that talented, you know, corner thing, or was that the car kind of trail braking
awesome.
And you didn't really feel it. Yes,
yeah,
we
yeah.
highly encourage this. If you can, it teaches you a lot, but to be honest, you need to understand the car control along with it first, because you know, let's say maybe a driving instruction or a driving school that would focus on things like that and actually address them instead of addressing, let's turn our turn signal on 100 feet before the light and let's start braking now and let's wait for the, you know, all the rules. So you're past that now. You want to take some instruction on here's how the car feels. And then you're going to start noticing the difference between the different platforms. So rear wheel drive, all wheel drive, all those things, and engine placement. You're going to start noticing that more. But I agree. Yes, it has a lot of merit, and there's many of you listening that have had that experience. I remember the car that I had. It had nothing on it, and I could feel the car. Well, you know, with modern safety technology comes hopefully a drop in insurance prices. It doesn't actually feel like it for some reason.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
But yes, we do agree it's important, but it's admittedly difficult to actually go experience that and find that unless you're going back to even earlier than Mustang. You know, let's go back to the old Toyota Corollas. And wow, Corollas for the win, for teaching you the feeling, right?
It's accidentally the Corolla podcast. Who knew?
Apparently.
Blair Smith wrote an interesting question. And Blair, you've backed your way into one of my rants. I don't think I've ranted on this before, but you've backed your way there. He recently drove a BRZ. So I'm glad you liked it. You said you drove it, you thought it was great, and you loved the gearbox feel. And your question is, the notchy mechanical feeling gearbox, you feel like you've heard automotive journalists talk about that being a bad thing. Why on earth you think that a notchy mechanical feeling gearbox is genius? Here's my rant, Blair. There isn't a standardization. And to be honest, this is to our benefit. But there isn't a standardization to all automotive journalists must learn the following things. And all automotive journalists must know the following terms because they mean blank. There are a few terms in journalism that I have read them as positive things and negative things, and it's the same words. Words should have consistent meanings. They just should when you have descriptive words. A lot of times I have read people talking about a notchy gearbox as being a bad thing. I don't think that's a bad term ever for a gearbox. I think you want to be able to feel every notch of the gearbox. You want to be able to slide it between. Look, the cliche is the rifle bolt thing, of course. I'm not going there. But actually feeling the mechanics of it as it slides between the various gear slots, I want it to have a notch that is clear to me. If it's just mush down in there, I mean, you've mentioned before, Paul, it's like stirring a bucket of nails. It's like it doesn't ever go anywhere.
Right.
What is first and third? I've got no idea. I don't have any idea. So having that notchy mechanical feeling, I think, is brilliant. And you're right. The 86 chassis has a surprisingly good gearbox for its price and just for sports cars in general. Honestly, the 86 gearbox is much better than my Lotus Elise, which is far less specific than the 86 six-speed. I think it's a good thing, but it's a term that I feel like gets used wrong a lot.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I want to get to a question over here from Bob W. on Facebook, who's asking about aftermarket mods and design trends. He says, I believe that form follows function. There are many of these trends and mods. He just doesn't understand. So what are trends and mods that we find absurd? Well, there's actually many. And let me talk about car culture in general. I'll give you an example. The stanced thing, the over camber, the negative camber where you're just rolling on the inside shoulder of your tires. destroying your bearings and wheels and tires, you know, early death for all of those parts. And everybody thinks it looks really cool, and I don't understand.
But dude, it's slammed. It's slammed, though. It's so slammed. I can't get out of the parking lot, but it's slammed.
There is that part of car culture, and you know, people enjoy that. And, you know, there's
and
the drag racers.
Loves.
There's the, drifters, on and on and on. So there's all the, and it's all valid. It's just, I don't understand it. I don't subscribe to it. I don't really like it. But there are a few things, one of them being the auto start-stop function that we've discovered on many modern cars.
Oh, man.
This is not an aftermarket mod. This is now becoming a standard thing that I want to break the button off.
It's the worst.
And I'll tell you why. It's because if you're at a stoplight and the engine dies and you're first at the light, you've got a responsibility to all the traffic behind you. All those people are waiting for you to really be on it, especially at a left turn light, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Welcome to L.A. Yeah.
And if you get on it and the car stumbles and sputters and then it's on, everybody behind you is going, all right, found the dork, you know, found the idiot. You know, you're doing something else besides paying attention to driving.
Yeah.
It's just become an annoyance. The aftermarket community, sometimes I think they just come up with stuff just so they can sell it. They didn't really think it through. They didn't really say, wow, that makes the front end look better. No, it actually looks like it got in an accident now, but that's actually what you can buy. You just paint it silver and you're good. It looks awful. There's a reason, you know, the design team at the car company chose that, and here the aftermarket car company pretty much ruined it. But then, of course, there's anything from the Tesla marketing brief that we find absurd is too strong, laughable, but definitely entertaining.
Well, you bring up an interesting point about the Tesla marketing brief. Look, any time you read the press material of any automotive car maker, I read them and I start laughing at some point during the press material because they say something that is such a reach for a feature or aren't we awesome. But Tesla, a Tesla who has plenty to genuinely brag about with their cars, reaches further than most. They have the most flowery, we are the best in the world PR people. I'm amazed the stuff leaves. As high end as it is, I mean, a lot of their stuff has this demeanor of the kid in your class in junior high that bragged so much you wanted them to go away, and they have plenty to brag about.
I can see that. Yeah, I like that.
All the PR stuff is massive across the board. But that's what those folks are paid to do. So okay, all right, there it is. Ace Sound One said, do we find that nowadays that we're shooting TV shows, we have to turn down press cars and not go to press events because we just can't make it work? No, actually. The thing is...
Despite everything going on.
Yeah. There's two things going on. We don't often go to press events because... We've been invited to a few, and we try to go. And look, we love being invited. We genuinely do. We often aren't invited, and I think one of the reasons that we aren't invited is because what we do does not merge with a press event. Press events, there's actually very little time in the car for automotive journalists during the press event. We, as everyday driver, need to take your car for the next 6 hours and not be bothered. We need to go shoot it. We need to go to a location and shoot it. We need it for 6 hours. There is pretty much no press event on the planet that is a 6 hour drive with the car. It just doesn't happen. You've got a classroom session here and a talk with the engineer there and a luxurious lunch here, and you might get an hour in the car. That isn't useful for the two of us. So press events aren't great. But then the secondary thing is, even though we've been doing this a decade and also are on TV, and a lot of the automotive companies, please don't misunderstand me, they're very supportive of us. They know exactly who we are. They like getting us cars, but the L.A. specifically and the U.S. in general, it's actually – the ratio is not good of journalists to press cars, and it's hard to get cars. People we know in both Canada and England have less trouble getting into press cars than we do because there's just more press cars and fewer journalists. And Motor Trend is the big 800-pound gorilla here.
Yeah, for
because
sure.
Because if they pull the 3 Series, they pull all of them, every 3 Series out there. And they return them when they want to.
Right.
Okay.
There's no schedule. Well, we're not done shooting yet. And so,
exactly.
When you request
so
one,
as a result,
you're out
they
of
can
luck.
Get whatever they want, and everybody else is fighting for the cars that are left. There have been plenty of times we have chased a specific car for a shoot, And the manufacturer wanted us to have it, but our shoot dates, it was impossible to get it. So while I would love to think we are turning cars down, and we will take everyone we can get, honestly, we've actually got ways to have more cars coming in 2019. Teaser. But at the same time, we are fighting for every car we get. But we love doing it.
All right. There's a question from Jeff H. over on Facebook, who is asking about stereotypes and says, do we have any favorites, you know, when you see erratic or annoying driving? And you pull up next to the driver to see if they match the image in your mind of who just committed that driving error, right? You know, old guys in
hats. This is a room full of rakes.
Middle-aged person on the phone. By the way, if you drive with your phone, please find a way to hook up Bluetooth. Please put the handset down. I implore you. I beg you. And then there's, agreed. You know, teen drivers or really anybody sitting way too close to the wheel because, by the way, that airbag is an explosive device. And you're sitting way too close to it.
Yeah.
Just saying, you know what? The biggest thing that I focus on right now, Jeff, is to look at their car and the movements of the car to see if they're going to come in and cut me off. Mm-hmm. Or if, you know, generally they're not paying attention when they're on their phone. But I'll look at the front wheels and you could actually, you know, you're, say, in their rear three quarter. And they're just ahead of you. So if they came into your lane, you'd be fine. You'd be too close, but you'd be fine. You're looking at their front wheels and you can see just the twitch. And you know, you think, here it comes, here it comes. And then here there's the turn signal, and then they're coming in. You think, yep, I read your body language, your car body language, whatever that is. I'm constantly doing that now and just watching the behavior of cars. And it almost doesn't matter who's driving because sometimes, well, many times, it doesn't match up. I think that's so, oh, well, that's a weird person to be doing that stupid thing. I wouldn't have thought that, but, you know, we've all thought that to ourselves, so... It's mainly the car motion that I'm looking at now and trying to read the room around me. But in this case, it's all cars. You know what I mean?
Discussing stereotypes, what could possibly go wrong? I've got a question I think we could probably leave it on if you want. And that is Casey Cook asking us, not really about dream cars, like big dream cars, but he's saying, what do we, you and me, Paul, what do we see ourselves owning in the next 5 years? Because you've got the Cayman GTS that you love, and I've got the Lotus Elise that I love.
Do.
He's going, would we get rid of those? Where would we want to go? Casey, here's my thinking. I was in the Elise briefly today, actually. It was warm enough. I needed to move it around for some stuff. And, I mean, driving it around in my driveway, I love that car. I mean, this is how much I have an obsession with it. But I still would love to have an Evora, specifically an Evora 400. In a few years, those will be down into somewhat reachable range, and an Evora 400 is a car I would move on to. I would almost do it for the base, the standard Evora S, but the 400 is a great car, and that's very me. So I would do that. And then, like, the next level up, like the one that I would love to reach to at some point would be the McLaren 570. I don't know they will be at a place to reach for. I don't know, you know, who knows how well the show will do in the next few years. You know, I don't see myself even, let's say the show is wildly successful. I don't see myself running out and buying $250,000 cars. I'd love to be wrong there, by the way. But, you know, I could see a world where the 570S gets down into, that's a stretch, but maybe I'll go anywhere. That would be cool. Is that 5 years away? We'll see. I don't know, man.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the 911 that I need to own in my life. I've been looking at the 3.2 Carreras. I've been really looking at those closely.
They're reachable for sure, yeah.
They are, but I can't reach them at this point. And got the Cayman. I love it. I'm also all about McLarens. I'm very much, you know, should it be possible, that's definitely on the list from a driving standpoint. But a 911's got to happen. And ultimately, I'd love it to be a manual GT3, like a 2018 GT3.
Ooh.
They're really expensive.
Ooh.
I admit they are blindingly expensive.
But they will come
down.
That's
certainly on my
list.
They
will come down.
And they seem pretty robust. So that's there. Well, guys, we are ending the podcast now with the questions. We are apologizing if we can't get to yours. Please keep writing to us.
So many good ones, yeah.
So many. We would love to keep hearing from you. If you've got your own car debate, everydaydrivertv@gmail.com or on the website. And thank you for your support. We are absolutely blown away by your support. It's amazing, honestly. And it's really helped us keep going. And by the way, we're resolute. We are putting this behind us. We've got the stories now. Mm-hmm. And I kept telling you through the whole shoot, anything that would happen, I said, well, at least we've got stories for the podcast. At least we've got a story to come away with.
Absolutely. We love sharing all of this stuff with you guys. We love sharing our lives with you guys. And you guys listening and sharing your lives with us is very cool. We are reading all those emails, even if we don't respond. We did read all the questions that were posted, even though we didn't get to all of those. We would welcome your reviews on Amazon for the TV show. That helps that grow and people find it. The same is true of this podcast. You rating and reviewing keeps it in the top 10 and helps people find it. So thank you guys for that support as well.
Finally, you're hearing episode 350. Thank you, guys.
There it was.
Cheers.
Technology Truths, brought to you by GEICO.
Technology Truths.
Truth, you will certainly send any text about your supervisor to your supervisor.
What's with Janet's fangs? Did she lose a bet with a weed whacker? LOL. And sent. Wait, no.
Truth, it's so easy to switch and save on car insurance at GEICO.com.
Janet, I think my phone was hacked or something.
GEICO, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Napa Know-How.
Right now, you can get a $20 prepaid Visa gift card by mail with the purchase of a Napa Legend Premium battery. Its durability and power make it the obvious choice for people who hate getting stranded by a dead car battery. So pretty much everyone. The Napa Legend Premium battery and $20 back. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa Know-How.
Napa Know-How.
At participating Napa Auto Parts stores and Napa Auto Care centers. Limit two per household while supplies last. Offer ends 2/28/19.
I'm Rita Foley with an AP News Minute. Federal government worker Blake Murray in D.C. says he's pretty much had it with the partial government shutdown.
It's pretty demoralizing, and I feel like kind of a pawn in a political game and totally powerless.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is asking President Trump to postpone his January 29th State of the Union address, citing security concerns. But Republicans say this is just politics, shutdown politics, a move intended to keep President Trump off the national stage. Going to prison for 20 years, a Tennessee teacher who took a 15-year-old student and ran for weeks. Prosecutor Dan Cochran.
We think it's a serious sentence. 20 years is a significant amount of time. He's going to have all that time to think about what he did, the consequences of it. We asked for 30, obviously, but 20 is a very serious sentence, and we feel good about it.
An employee and a customer at an IHOP restaurant in Huntsville, Alabama, were killed in a shooting that also injured another employee. I'm Rita Foley.